I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is actress and activist Maria Bello. She's joined in conversation by author Ayelet Waldman. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Maria Bello and Ayelet Waldman.
I'm so thrilled that we have Maria Bello here. She is a mother, actor, activist, and author. Her essay in the New York Times Modern Love column, Coming Out as a Modern Family, is one of the 10 most popular articles in a decade. Her Whatever campaign supports human and equal rights causes, with a portion of proceeds from the sale of products on the site going to support HRC, Quality Now, and We Advance. She lives in Los Angeles, and she accepts no other labels at this time. Maria is joined tonight in conversation by New York Times bestselling author Ayelet Waldman. So please join me to welcome Maria and Ayelet.
Oh, I know you're all as excited as I am. This is such a thrill. When I saw you for the first time, I'm not even going to say how old we both were, but you were kicking ass on one of my favorite TV shows, and then you turned in a performance in The History of Violence that has won you awards, New York Film Critics Circle Award, Golden Globe nominations. You are an astonishingly gifted actress, and it turns out an astonishingly gifted writer. So why don't you read some of your incredible words for us just to start us off in the best possible way?
Thank you so much for that. Coming from you, I mean, coming from her, can I just,
aww,
I'm really honored.
Thank you.
Really, thank you for doing this and for being here. Chapter 11, Am I LGBT or W? My first orgasm happened way before I knew it was called an orgasm. It wasn't with a man or a woman, it was with a pillow. I just felt the sensation in my body and I liked it. So back then, I didn't know if I was straight, lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, or a pillower. I am thinking maybe we should change the label to LGBTP. Yes, let's add a P, but not for pillow. Let's add a P to honor a great black, gay, transgender AIDS activist. Her name was Marsha P. Johnson. When people asked her what the P stood for, she said it meant, pay it no mind. To me, she was proclaiming herself a whatever. In July of 1992, I was sitting on a cement wall overlooking the Hudson River with a sweet boy from Long Island that I had been dating for a year. We were looking at the water on a sunny day, just minutes from breaking up. I was very into my full moon goddess circles and rituals at the time, and the down-to-earth Catholic boy was freaked out by that. I had told him I was a witch the day before. That didn't go over well. He didn't think his mother would approve and was about to tell me goodbye when I pointed at something bobbing in the water. What's that? I asked. He said, a log. I said, no, it's not. I think it's a head. When I walked closer to the pier, I could see it clearly. It's a head. It was a head. Attached to a bloated, fish-bitten, gray-colored corpse. I asked a passing biker to get the police. My boyfriend ran away spooked, as he was sure I had conjured it. Turns out the floating body was none other than the magnificent black American gray transgender, gay transgender AIDS activist Marsha P. Johnson. Afterward, I saw her photo on every street corner around Christopher Street where I lived. I remembered seeing this always smiling, flamboyant, beautiful woman, but I never had the fortune to meet her. Her friends and supporters came forward to say that she was not suicidal, as the police had theorized, but the police refused to investigate. The poster campaign said she had been harassed and gay-bashed in the very same spot where she died. It wasn't until 2012 that the New York City Police Department reopened Marsha's case. They now think the most likely that she was murdered, I'm currently trying to find out where the case stands and to find ways to honor her. We're doing a movie on her, by the way.
Oh, that's great.
Marsha was a true revolutionary for gay rights and for human rights. Marsha was one of the transgender folks who led the 1969 Stonewall riots at the bar in the West Village that I was a half a block from my apartment. Marsha was at the forefront of that fight and the many that followed in New York as the LGBT community fought for equal rights. She started an organization to bring food and clothes to the young trans women who were living on the docks and nearby Christopher Street. She used her voice and her tremendous stilettos to create a better world. Marsha is one of the reasons I became part of the LGBT community long before I slept with a woman. She taught me even after she was gone that it's not about who you sleep with. It's about who you fight for and who you love. Let's be honest. Not everyone who sleeps with someone from the same gender cares about the great LGBT struggle for equality. They'll wink and nod at you like, oh, cool, you're sleeping with a woman. After my article, a woman came up to me at a luncheon and said, welcome to the club. She was a well-known lesbian in the entertainment community. I had known her a bit over the years and found her sneaky, hard, and a bit mean. I wanted to say, I don't want to be in your damn club. You're an a-hole. The club the woman was talking about was just about sexuality. And then I saw a man across the room, apparently a straight man who plays a gay man on the television show, and I thought, the LGBT club he belongs to is the one I want to be a part of. A club that includes anyone who believes in human rights and allows anyone, regardless of what they call themselves. The club I want to belong to is full of revolutionaries, fighting for theirs and other people's rights to love who they love. But like any club, I won't like everyone in it. I won't be interested in being identified with them. Claire has always been a whatever. Having relationships with men and women, sleeping with some and not with others. It just doesn't matter to her. But it mattered to me. Here's the thing I got. She's not a woman or a man. She's Claire. My mother taught me to pray for a certain way, not to pray for a certain way a relationship should go, but to pray for a relationship to be the best that it was meant to be. I hope that in the near future, saying that you are LGBT will be just like saying what you prefer for breakfast. Why should we care who's having sex with whom, or who is attracted to whom? When I first kissed a girl at 21, it wasn't because I wanted to have sex with her. I just thought it would be fascinating to kiss a beautiful woman with bright red lips in a bathroom. It was a secret, so very sexy. But was that sex? Was I officially bisexual when I kissed the girl? Or was I officially bisexual when I was turned on by seeing two women kissing in a movie? Does the fact that I have only had sex mostly with men in my life and have mostly fantasized about men mean anything? I've wondered whether a man who has been married for 40 years but kissed a boy once when he was 10 because he was curious and attracted is bisexual. If a woman has only had sex with men but fantasizes about a woman to have an orgasm, is she bisexual? How often and how far do you have to go to consider yourself bisexual? And if you have had sex with a woman and enjoyed it, but years later are only having sex with men, can you call yourself gay? When people ask how long Claire and I have been together, I don't know what to say. Was it from the day at the bar when she gave me her hat? Or years later when we kissed, or when we first had great sex, or when we shouted our love out to the world? I knew that the gender of the person I loved didn't matter. It was the love itself that mattered. There are no labels that can define my relationship with Claire. This relationship, like all relationships, is constantly evolving. Call it destiny, God, or whatever. We teach each other and we push each other to grow every day. And though the form of our relationship changes, the love is always the same. So many people in the LGBT community have sacrificed so much to change policy, hearts, and minds. The entire world has benefited from their sacrifices beyond LGBT rights. The community has fought, marched, shouted, laughed, cried, all to move policy and to show the world it shouldn't matter to anyone who you love or who you sleep with. That's the part of the LGBT community I respond to the most. The struggle to love whomever you want without being disenfranchised. An extraordinary thing about the LGBT community has done is take back labels that were used to demean and disempower and turn them into proud badges. Queer, gay, dyke, lesbian, and transvestite, pretty much the terms I knew growing up. So here we all today, calling our community of revolutionaries lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. Will we have to add more initials to honor all the communities who are defining their own identities, such as asexual, gender neutral, trans, bi, etc., and why not? These are people who ought to have their own rights too. So I consider myself a W, a whatever. And I'm lucky enough to have found another whatever, W, to love. I also take the label of LGBT and whatever other letter you want to add. But I will especially take P. Or we can just get rid of all the letters and instead use the phrase, pay it no mind, because it's no one's business anyway. Thank you, gorgeous Marsha P. Johnson.
That's great. I'm so glad you started with that story. I was going to ask you about her. She sounds like the most remarkable woman. So let's start. The title of the book is so great, right? So the title is Whatever Love is Love.
Yep.
And I want you to tell the story, if you would, about your son and okay. how this came to be. How did you get the title of the book? How did you get the word whatever? Where did it come from?
In the summer of 2013, I was ill, and I looked up at my bedside. I looked around me, and there were people standing there. It was my mother and my brother and my son's dad and my son and Claire. And I looked up, and I thought, these are all partners in my life. And the reason I came to that is because what my son Jackson said a couple of months before that, when I began a romantic relationship with my dearest friend Claire, who was like a godmother to Jack, I did not know how to tell my son. How do you tell a kid that? Right. He was 12. And so I went to a therapist, a child therapist, and she said, wait till he asks. I said, all right. So I waited for months for him to ask, of course. And she said, whatever he says about his mother in life, he'll never say she was boring. I said, all right, at least I got that. So one night Jack asked me, are you in a romantic relationship? And I said, yes. And he said, with who? And I said, Claire. And he had this big smile on his face, and he said, Mom, whether you're lesbian, gay, straight, transgender, or whatever, love is love. Shout it out to the world.
Oh, that's great.
I was like, what? And this child, that moment completely transformed my life and made me start thinking about labels and what they all meant.
So, you know, I have a bunch of kids, and my oldest is 20, and I feel like when she talks about her sexuality, when her friends talk about their sexualities, the same is true all the way, my younger daughter as well, they seem to have so much more ease about it than our generation did. I mean, they sort of say, oh yeah, he's heteroflexible, or she's heteroflexible. Like, what do you think? Do you think?
I'm with you. I understand. Last year, Facebook added 51 new gender identities and orientations,
right?
Besides male and female. And I looked it up, and I'm like, I'm at least 15 of these. I mean, look up cisgender. Many of us in this room are cisgender. You would never know, but you look up these definitions, and these kids, they're really leading the way. They're saying to people, we're many different things. My label doesn't fit into a box. I always joke and say LGBT. Pretty soon it's going to be the whole alphabet. LGBT, A, B, C, D, da, da, da. And the more of us, the better, right? Standing in line and marching.
Right, absolutely. So do you feel like maybe it's just that you're just super youthful? Is that the key? Like,
what
that's
do you mean?
Why,
what do you mean youthful?
That's why you just have this incredibly young soul, and you captured that moment. The whatever you've given a name of to this sense that kids have of infinite possibility.
Yeah, I think, you know, whatever used to be like a shrug, whatever.
Right.
And whatever now is it's a call to, yeah, be who you are if it's authentic and based in love, and that the only labels you have are the ones you give yourself or you should have. So labels that disempower you, get rid of them. Labels that make you feel powerful or feel proud to be part of a community, take them. Take them all or embrace them or make new ones up.
So this, you know, you sort of, I remember I was sitting at my computer, where I often am, and I got a text from a Facebook message from a friend, and she said, "Oh my God, Maria Bello just came out on in the New York Times." And I'm like, "What?" And I know you must have heard that. Maria Bello just came out. Like, yeah, it was right. Some... So what you came out as is rejecting the whole notion of labels and of words. But were you afraid? Were you... I mean, it's a big place to make an announcement like this in the New York Times. Lots of people read it.
I have to say I've been, for the last decade... Since the Modern Love column, I religiously, that's the first thing I go to every Sunday, is Modern Love column. And I wrote a couple of them, and I never sent them in, and I thought, one day. And then that one day was, it was after my son's dad's 50th birthday party that Claire and Jack and I had thrown. Mm-hmm. My parents had flown out for it. My brother was there, all of Dan's family. And I looked around this room and felt so much love and was so proud of our family, this untraditional crazy family and our love. I went, I need to write that down. So I wrote it in an hour. I sent it to Dan Jones the next day, who I didn't know, and he called me. He's like, "Are you sure you want to print this?" And I said, "Yeah."
Were you ever hesitant? Was there ever a moment like the night before it hit the
internet?
No. You were there. And what about professionally? I mean, did you think you might pay a price as an actress? Like suddenly they wouldn't, you know, people might hesitate before casting you?
Do you know, by that time I was over it because I had been sick. I'd had the parasite, these people standing by my bed. I was like, who cares what anybody thinks of me? It was that sort of wake-up moment. And I'm not saying I still feel like that every day. I want you all to like me desperately. You know, but in that moment, there was the moment of enlightenment where I went, oh, this is the thing that really, really matters. So by the time I wrote the column, I felt really proud. And you know, and within an hour, we had 273,000 Facebook hits.
Wow.
Of people saying from all over the world, I'm a whatever too, and I didn't know what to call it. I have a whatever family too. I'm whatever religiously. Mm-hmm. What is this? And then I realized there was a larger conversation to be had. It's like what, you know, your piece in the Modern Love column inspired me in a lot of ways to ask questions about, you know, to ask questions about that and what that really means about partnership and husbands and children, and you opened up this huge conversation, and you probably didn't expect it.
No, I didn't at all. But it's also true that I felt like there was, I mean, a lot of what I got was negative blowback, and it sounds like you got overwhelmingly positive blowback. But did you ever feel... Are you laughing at me? Did you ever feel exposed, or was there a sense that it was the exposure the point, is maybe what I'm asking? Like, was there ever a moment of nervousness after it all went up? Like, whoa, now suddenly I'm in a kind of public eye. I've always been in the public eye, but I'm in a kind of public eye that I didn't really
Do you know, it was more about. I was, like, floating. It was more Claire going, like, okay, so you're talking about me. I have never, I've never like, publicly proclaimed my love for anyone. And my friend Cameron Mannheim, she said, it's such a sweet, beautiful, like, love letter about Claire and Jack and Dan. And Claire was like, I don't think so. so it was harder for her. But, you know, I felt really good about it. But my son didn't read it, which is really interesting. I told him the night before it was coming out. I said, Jack, something you said inspired me. I decided to write this article. It's coming out tomorrow. He was like, good for you, Mom. And I said, it's in the Modern Love section. And he goes, that's your favorite column. That's what you read every Sunday. And I went, yes, it is. And so it wasn't until months later that he read it. Because he said some friends had come up to him and said they read this. And I said, you know, whatever you want, you just read it. And I'm at a friend's birthday party in Connecticut. And I get a text from Jack. And it says, Mom, I just walked outside of the bathroom and I saw your article that Claire framed for you. And I read it for the first time. And I cried.
Aww.
And it moved me so much. These aren't his exact words. I mean, he was 12. Or 13 by that time. And he was really proud. And I feel proud whenever I see the book, whenever I see the title, I feel so proud of him. Going, that's kind of an incredible human being.
Can I tell you a really warm, touching story about what my kids have said about my writing?
Yes, please.
Things like, I'd never read that in a million years. It's too gross. You and Daddy always write about sex. I don't want any part of that. Yeah, you have a really special kid.
Yeah.
You're listening to actress and activist Maria Bello, whose new book is Whatever, Love is Love, Questioning the Labels We Give Ourselves. She's joined in conversation by author Ayelet Waldman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Okay, this book, one of the things that I love, so many things about this book, but the thing that I think that I love the most about it is that it is just brutally honest. And honest about so many things. There is, it's like, I felt like you were taking risks on all of our behalf. And one of the things you talked about is something that I care a tremendous amount about, is you were honest about your family's history with bipolar disorder. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about that and tell us about what it was like to, you know, be from a family with bipolar disorder, which we can both empathize with, and tell us about what it was like to write about it.
You know, it was really interesting. I was first, I was always a very moody kid. I didn't quite understand why I would go through these kind of suicidal depressions and dips and not be able to leave my bed for months and then be on these highs. And when I was 28 years old, I was in another one of these places, very suicidal, found myself in the middle of nowhere's man, land's man, in Arizona. I forget where I was, in a Holiday Inn or something. And my friends, thank God, found me, took me back, and this kind doctor said to me something I'll never forget. He said, Maria, if you're nearsighted, you need glasses to see. And you have this disease, like any other disease, it's called bipolar disorder, and you need glasses to see. And here's medicine that'll help you. Here's talk that will help you. Here's this. And it changed my life. And I think that, you know, I look at Kay Jamison Redfield. I look at Touched by Fire. I look at these incredible stories of these people, artists throughout centuries, amazing people who have killed themselves because of this disease because they didn't have medication at the time. And now, you know, my father has this disease. My sister does. And whenever you do a film, they make you do this insurance thing. The doctor comes to your house, they take your blood pressure, are you healthy, you sign this thing. And just 6 months ago, I decided to write, because they say, what prescriptions are you on? And I only write usually Synthroid, because I have a thyroid disease. But this time, I decided to write something different. I said, Lamictal, Abilify, Prozac, just to see what they would say. My lawyer called me and said, they want you to sign a special paper saying you will take all psychiatric meds during your time shooting. And I said, no. And so did he, because the whole point was, so we finally negotiated to the point where it said, you will take all medicine prescribed by any doctor that you have.
Because I mean, nobody's telling the diabetic that they have to commit to taking their insulin.
Exactly. And it's the same thing. And I think that there's been such a stigma and a shame around mental illness when that's exactly what it is. It's an illness. And thank God much of it can be treated and helped. And now I think of my bipolar as a gift in many ways. I've been to the bottom of the barrel. I know what that is. There's not a human being I meet that I think, oh, I haven't been in that place.
Mm-hmm. Do you use it, that experience? Can you access it as an actress? Is that part of what you use as your method to kind of get to the dark places on screen or on stage?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I always feel like there's 100 different bits living in there, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of them, like kind of like in pain, depressed young woman or older woman at times. And for certain parts, I'll pick that piece up and kind of bring it here to the surface. And that's what I'll lead with. Like in The Cooler, for instance, in the movie I did The Cooler, or History of Violence even.
Yeah.
It was that place of not trusting. It was that place of trying to be perfect and holding on. So I just take those pieces and I put them in front to play Edie.
So is that ever dangerous for you? Because I know, I also have a mood disorder, and sometimes I mean, it's the greatest gift when I'm writing.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like I'm waking the tiger, and I get nervous.
I get it. Okay, so Anne Lamott, Writing Down the Bones, Stephen King's on writing. I'm sure you've read all of these. Mm-hmm. What we're supposed to do as writers is sit down every day and write 5 pages and light a candle and do this thing every day. Guess what? That's not who I am. That's what I figured out. Like, I would go 2 weeks without writing, stabbing myself in the eye, going like, oh my God, I need to write. And then I would stay up on a manic spree and write like 40 pages a night.
Right.
And that was...
I went sort of book in 2 weeks.
I love it.
God bless.
Did you go off your meds to do it, or were you on the meds as you wrote the book?
I was on a version of the meds. We could have the meds
love
conversation.
It.
My favorite website is called crazymeds.org. Have you ever been on it?
No.
Oh, get thee to a phone when we get off the stage. It's the
best. I can't wait. Crazymeds.com.
Yeah.
Fantastic. We do some of our best work.
Absolutely. I mean, hypomania is a beautiful thing. It really is. Okay, so you talked about history balance, and that one of the other things that you've been... Oh, before I go there, I have to ask you this question. This is just for me. I mean, who cares what everybody else thinks? But, like, do you and your dad... Do you talk about your shared diagnosis? Do you feel like you can, you know, share medication stories? That kind
yes.
of, you can't?
I have to say
I'm
that
so
I
jealous.
I got my dad on the medication that I was turned on to, changed
yeah.
his medication, so he's in a really, really good space. But I do want to say, after the book came out, which my dad loved, signed off on, so did my mother, my, like, old uncles were going like, you never had bipolar, what's that?
That's
ridiculous. You're just, you know, you're just angry a lot.
because if he does, then so do they, right?
Exactly.
So
I was like, yeah. And definitely the uncle who said that definitely is.
Right.
So.
It's interesting. I wonder what, you know, my dad is 90 and he's just, we can't talk about it.
Does he share that with you?
Nope. We just can't talk about it. We can't, even though, I mean, I'll sort of bring it up. I'm like, hey, what's on lately? What do you, and.
Oh, so he has the same disorder as you do. Disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. But doesn't feel comfortable talking about it. Maybe he's just.
But you try to.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Because it's a shame thing. I think it's that generation as well.
Right.
And when I told my son, I was trying to think of, because he didn't want to read the book before it came out. He still doesn't want to read the book. He's so busy.
Yeah.
You know, he's like 14 soccer
Plus,
girls.
Plus, you know,
whatever.
You talk about sex, it's gross.
That's what I said. I said, there's like sex stuff in here. You don't want to read it. He's like, I don't care, Mom. I'll read it. Okay, fine.
Maybe I'm definitely going to have my kids call yours.
I was going on to these talk shows, and I realized as I was taking him to get a haircut the day before I was leaving for New York, oh my God, I never told him some stuff. I never told him like I was bipolar, and people are asking me about that. So I said, Jack, there's some things in the book I should probably tell you about. And he said, what? And I said, well, okay, one, I'm bipolar. He goes, yeah, I know. You're like angry sometimes, and then you're like really nice, and then it's like that, right? But we ended up having this interesting conversation, and he said, Mom, he said, why didn't you tell me before? And I said, I thought you were too young to comprehend it, and I also thought, you know, I was ashamed in a way to tell you. And he goes, well, if I like had ADD, why would I be ashamed to tell you? It's the same sort of thing.
Man, he's a wise kid.
Yeah, he's a wise-ass kid is what he is.
So did you have any, like when you had him, were you ever afraid? I mean, your dad, you're really honest in the book about the periods in your dad's life where he wasn't the greatest father, where his bipolar disorder and his substance abuse were farther in the front of his self than his parenting side. And were you ever afraid thinking about having kids, thinking about being a mom, that you wouldn't be able to do it the way you wanted to because of this disorder?
I mean, you know about this. Any parent knows about this. And I don't care if you're like a parent of a child or it's like your dog or whoever you're committed to and you have to take care of. I write a chapter about this in my book. It's called, you know, Am I a Good Mommy? Like that syndrome of me, you know, him at 6 years old in a car and me yelling like out a window to someone because they cut me off and him going, Mom. And I thought, oh my God, he's found me out. He found me out. I'm not perfect. I'm not like, I don't bake cookies when he gets home. I don't do all of that. But I give him adventures. Mm-hmm. But I definitely every day question mm-hmm. if I'm a good enough mom. It's getting better now. It's definitely getting better. We definitely went through something in the beginning of this year, and I'm sure you've been through this with your kids. You know, I related to a certain way with him when he was 12.
Right.
And suddenly he's 14, and I was still relating to him as if he was 12. And he was like trying to get out of the box. You know, without actually saying that, he didn't have the words for it, but right. I had to learn how to relate with this new person, right. this person who was evolving and growing. And I guess that's the point of my book in the end, is that relationships are fluid and life is fluid. And as soon as we accept that as not the possibility, but the norm, and that's right. just what it is, the more honest we can be about that, then perhaps the happier we'll be.
For sure. Amen. Right? That yeah. deserves some applause. Okay, so among the things that Jack will freak out about if he reads this book is this, you write about sex in such a great way, and one of the things I've always admired so much about you is that you are a sexually empowered woman in Hollywood, which is not necessarily the norm. I feel like there's still all of these sort of rules about how you get to be if you're an actress and if you're a beautiful actress and how you're supposed to behave and, you know, you're supposed to have how many sex partners it's okay to have and what makes you a slut and all that. And so right. Were you conscious about your identity as a sexual being in terms of being on screen, and how has that played out for you, and what's that been like? And
that's a great question that I haven't been asked for a long time. You know, I was watching Outlander the other night. Anyone watch Outlander?
Oh, me too. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. It's like such it's bad Harlequin, point, but it's so good. Yeah, this and, you know, it was like, all right. So I'm watching Outlander, and there's like full frontal nudity. There's like sex scenes that last for 15 minutes. Cut to 12 years ago, Bill Macy and I sitting in front of the ratings committee for a movie we did called The Cooler. We had to argue with them to keep one of our scenes in, and the scene was Bill moving down my body, and it looked like he was about to go down on me, which it looked like that's what he was supposed to look like. And they wanted to cut the scene.
And you two went in.
And we two went in and argued the rating board and said, you know, we talked about the violence on the screen and the blood and the gore and why not this nudity? And there's another, you know, a scene of us like pushing a bed against a frame with our asses sticking mm-hmm. out, which he and I made up the night before while we were drinking scotch, by the way. Funny. We just thought it would be funny. So to see where it's come now and to feel that I have somehow been a part of that movement, even with a movie like Coyote Ugly,
right?
Which even then some talk shows were saying, well, you know, isn't it just, you know, you're putting women out there as like these sexual beings, you're sexualizing them. We were like, no, actually what it's about is a woman taking back her own sexuality and being in her own skin. So I think I've been part of that movement. I just realized it.
Absolutely. And also, you know, as yeah, right? What I love, too, is that you are part of that and you have not ceded your sexual identity after 40. Like, you've maintained this. You and there's a couple of other, you know, actresses of your stature who have said, you know, I can be sexy at 40, I can be sexy at 45, I can be sexy at 48, however old I am, which is really exciting to a woman who turned 50 this year.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
When's your birthday?
It was December. I'm still assimilating it. It's okay. It's all
got
right.
it. Got it.
It's a dealing.
Yeah, I got it. But I look at Helen Mirren, or I look at Charlotte Rampling. I look at Jane Fonda, who I know, who is like, you're like, oh my God, I would sleep with them so quick. Like, if you had a chance, man, woman, you'd be like, oh my God. They're like the sexiest, because it's like how they walk in their skin, how they move, you know? Mm. And older men have that grace as well, I think.
For sure.
Some.
And no matter how old they are, they'll still be cast opposite the 26-year-old voluptuous
yeah,
girl.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what's that? What is it? Do you have like a theory of what it is to be a woman over 40 in Hollywood? Or have parts changed for you? Or are you making your own parts now?
The thing that I first understood about women crying out all the time and saying there's no roles for women in Hollywood over 40, I thought it's because everybody gets face work to try to look like somebody who's 20, so there's not many 40-year-olds who actually look 40. So when I realized that, and I said, like, oh, God, don't get Botox. How about that? And then you'll get the roles for a 40-year-old, because there are some. The second part was, you're so right, and we talk about this all the time, about not being women's roles in Hollywood, great roles, women directors, they are not respected, blah, blah, blah. But new studies have shown that stories from diverse voices make the most money. Really? Stories, films, and TV with the most diverse cast make the most money. films with leading women right now are making just as much money as men as men's films. So we've started a production company called Ground Seven. Our partners, I'm so happy, are all from San Francisco, so we love to be here. And it's about diverse voices and telling these stories of heroes and heroines on seven continents. And it's an exciting process.
I can't wait. It'll give us something to go to at the movies. I do this thing with my kids where we go to the movies together, and then I'm like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
Enjoy. I'm sure the Avengers is wonderful. I'm going to scoot over here and see Ida or something. Sometimes you just like to see yourself on screen.
I agree.
And when you're an older woman, it gets harder and harder to find, you know, that reflection of all of yourselves, not just the one that's, you know, someone's mom.
That's right.
Okay, so this time is just winging by, and I want to make sure we talk about Haiti. You have this incredible chapter where you talk about how Haiti is your mistress. And I want you to tell us a little bit about why Haiti. What is it about that place that seems to have wormed itself into your soul and your heart? And what kind of work are you doing, particularly with We Advance?
The first time my foot stepped on the ground in Haiti, I knew I was done. It just took me. And I didn't know till years later, when I have a lot of Haitian, great, beautiful family and friends. They said the spirit of Erzuli took you. And it's a voodoo goddess, and she's the mother protector and also the destroyer. And the smells, the sights, the color, the music, the dance. I don't care if you're the poorest of the poor, and that's where We Advance worked right after the earthquake, was in the poorest slum in the Western Hemisphere, kids washing their bodies in the same water that their mothers were boiling their dinner in. It's that poor. But even in those poorest areas, the most joy and laughter. And then at the top of the hill in Pechonville, which looks like Beverly Hills, all of these, you know, young people who have come back, been, you know, gone overseas to be educated and come to rebuild this country. And some of the most beautiful places on earth, my favorite place is called Jacmel. You go over this mountain path, and it's this beach in the middle of nowhere, and it's a town that looks like New Orleans. And I remember getting there and seeing it and running in with my clothes into this water. It was like Erzuli, this goddess, like pulling me out into this water. And you know, from then on, it was just my life for 3 years, especially. I was there before the earthquake, but after the earthquake, for 3 years, it was all I thought about, all I did. You know, every person I was related to, in relationship with, we were all involved with this woman, and it brought us together, and it tore us apart. I saw the best of what human beings could be, and I saw the worst of what I could be, and the best of what I could be. And in that chapter, I read about being a humanitarian, and I say, I don't think I am a humanitarian if it's just serving selflessly, because I think sometimes, you know, those of us who are in disaster zones, that sort of thing, we are going to give relief, but we're also going to get relief.
Right. And that's okay. I mean, you know, there's a sense that altruism has to be completely altruistic.
Right.
But what I always, you know, when we teach kids, and one of the things I always say to my kids is, you know, doing things for other people makes you feel good. That's the dirty secret. You don't have to do it for them. Just do it for yourself, because it makes you feel better.
Exactly. Exactly right. We all have our own motivations. I wish I was Gandhi, but I'm not.
So now what's
the
situation?
Someone said to me the other day, this is funny, because it was a San Francisco reporter, and he said, so your website, whatever, loveislove.com, and we have we have great products, and, you know, our products that, you know, the 90% goes back to HRC, Equality Now, and then the more, like, upscale, the next level of products, not, you know, 10% goes to HRC. And he's like, now, why is that? You're trying to make money? And I'm like, I'm not a charity. I was like, I have a charity, but I'm not a charity.
Absolutely.
And so it's hard for some people to kind of wrap their minds around that. They think, like, you write a book about love, like, why would you make money off of that?
I was just rereading Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, and everyone always remembers
one
the
of my
room
favorite
part.
Books ever.
Right, but the money part is a big thing for her. I mean, she says she's all about, like, a woman needs 500 pounds a year, and that's what gives you the liberty to be an artist, and you can't hide from the fact that you need to earn a living and support your children and support the people you love.
That's right.
And that we're so, we, you know, we we're happy to claim our room, but we're afraid to claim the money that we're owed. So you go ahead and take your money off your website.
You too,
sister.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features actress and activist Maria Bello, whose new book is Whatever, Love is Love, Questioning the Labels We Give Ourselves. She's joined in conversation by author Ayelet Waldman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
One of the things that's very clear in this book is that you come from a long line of supremely kick-ass women. And I want you to tell us a little bit about them. Is it Babchi? Is that?
Bachi.
Bachi. All right, so start with your Bachi.
It's spelled Babchi, but we call her Bachi.
Start with Bachi and then on your mom. And just tell us about these women from whose loins you have sprung.
Yes, I shall. I feel like I've always been a feminist, but I never knew that word. And when I learned the word, it was through Gloria Steinem. It was through my studies at school. But when I looked back, I realized that my grandmother and my mother were feminists. They just didn't have the word for it. My grandmother, who came from Poland, who worked in a sewing mill, and who, you know, got divorced, lost her husband, raised four kids, was living on dirt floors, started her own sewing business. She, like, started a startup, basically, my grandmother, to educate her kids and keep them healthy. And she never graduated high school, neither did my grandfather. And here was my mother, again, another feminist who didn't know it, who figures out a way to apply to nursing school, who's top of her class, and the priest is saying, we won't let you join the honor society because your boyfriend is really bad for you, Joe Bello, my dad. And the nuns fighting for her and looking back and going, they're feminist as well. And my mother being a nurse and being in the emergency room when these women came in who were poor women who tried to give themselves abortions, and many of them died and, would never be able to have children again. And even though my mom was raised Catholic, she said, well, why? They should have the same opportunity to, they shouldn't suffer like this. So when I looked back at these strong women, I realized that that was the modeling I had. I didn't have a label for it.
Right.
But that was my modeling. And now, I fully take the word feminist. I love this word. But it's become this polarizing discussion in a way, with a lot of young women coming out and saying, I am not a feminist. People coming out and saying, I am a feminist. But the truth is, if you have the platform and you're able to even shout it out to the world, I am not a feminist, you're a feminist.
Right, exactly.
Pretty much.
And what about raising a feminist boy? How do we do that? What's the trick there?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know about this. My son, he had to take an elective at school, and he wanted to take ping pong. Because his other four classes was like,
Latin,
basketball. Right. No. Every elective was like a lame thing. So ping pong. And I said, okay, you cannot take ping pong. You have to take one serious class as an elective. So he went to his dean, and his dean put him in gender studies.
Awesome.
And I pick up Jack that day from school, and he's like this. And I'm like, what's wrong? He's like, Mom, gender studies. It's so stupid. Why do people even have that? Everyone knows boys and girls are equal. And I went, right on. So we're doing something right.
Absolutely. So Haiti isn't the only place that you've done this humanitarian work. And again in the book, we see stories from all of these incredible women. Tell us about some of these women that you write about in different places around the world.
I have been so blessed from when I was 20-something years old to be able to travel around the world, even though once I did so with like $1,000 for 3 months in Europe. And I've met extraordinary, extraordinary people, but I mostly work with women. And from a camp in Bosnia during the war, these beautiful women who had lost lovers and husbands and children, and to weep with them in these barracks, and the next thing for us to be doing each other's nails and doing makeup on each other and laughing, I was like, this is who we are, right? That resilience. And I see that over and over again, traveling all over the world in cultures. Women, we have very similar themes that we talk about. It's like our children, boys and sex, and hair and makeup, besides the more important things. But there is this sense of connection. And I think through the internet right now, and that's what we're doing at We Advance, connecting women throughout the country and hopefully throughout the world that are saying, oh, you're having that experience as well. Hey, I'm having this experience. So that this community is really starting to know each other and realize how similar we really are.
That's fabulous. That's great. I think we should, I know there are so many people in this audience who have questions for you, so I think we should turn up the lights and ask some questions. All right, there's a question right there.
So I have a question for you, my love. Here we are in the wonderful Jewish community, and I've known this place when I lived here. And you had a chatter around, am I Catholic? And here we are again, you know, talking about labels, and there are so many different people here of different nominations. I would love to know a little bit more about how you feel after this book tour, after being home and being here.
That's a really good question, Claire. We don't have time to talk about that tonight, later, in bed, on the airplane, nothing. Okay. The funny thing is, when I look at our book tour, we've done at least three places, Claudia, if you correct me, that were JCC. And I went, what's that about, this openness? What is that?
We like strong women.
Yeah, maybe that's it, the strong woman thing. But, you know, I really had to ask myself, was I Catholic? My best friend at university was a Catholic priest, an Augustinian priest. We certainly didn't agree on the church doctrine. I was very... But he loved me nonetheless, and he felt there was room for different voices in great religions. And so I fell away from the Catholic Church. And then, but it was my heritage. I went to Catholic Church for 16 years, Catholic school. And when I got sick, the first thing I did wasn't go, om. The first thing I did was reach for these rosary beads that Father Ray had given me. And I started to realize that this was, you know, Catholicism was my heritage, but it was a Catholicism that was based in love. And, you know, my Jewish friends, my Muslim friends, my Buddhist friends, we share that similarity. It's not about what book says what and what the guy's name is. Whatever the guy's name is, whatever. Thank you, whatever. That religion that is based in love, that's really a human religion. But, you know, mine I see through the lens of Catholicism. So me and the Pope, we're claiming that right now.
Yeah, good Pope,
He's a good one. Yeah, really good.
About time.
He's about inclusiveness.
Yeah.
People are coming back to the church. My son wanted to go to a Catholic boys' school of all things this year.
Wow.
We're like, what?
What grade is he in?
How are we going to get him in a Catholic boys' school? He's going into ninth, and he goes to a very progressive school in L.A., but he wanted more structure and more academics. And, you know, we didn't think we had to get a letter from a pastor. And we finally heard about this church right near our house, and we went in to meet the pastor. And he said, oh, Maria, I loved your article so much. Your son sounds amazing. And I went, oh, thank you, Father. So I'm back in.
That's great.
And he's going to that school.
Awesome.
Hi, I have a couple questions. It's interesting because you were talking about the Catholicism. My question was, I'm an Italian Catholic myself, or raised Catholic, I should say. How was it for your family with your newfound lifestyle? That's the first question. And the second question, would you ever consider with your movie production bringing your book to the screen? Maybe directing it yourself?
About my family... It wasn't like how they were accepting my lifestyle. They've always had to accept my lifestyle that's like this. So it wasn't like a new thing that I was going to be like, oh my God, so here's what I figured out. And here's where my life is right now. So it was sort of they were used to that idea. And thank God I have parents that have done a lot of work on themselves and brothers and a sister and who have done the same that we're all excited for each other's new discoveries and curious, and not that it's not hard sometimes, right? I mean, I know you writing books and some personal things come up sometimes, and it can hurt people. And I was really afraid of that, of hurting people. And I'm sure it does. And I just have to believe that you know there's a reason for it, and it's okay. And in terms of my book going to the big screen, there's parts of it that will, little bits that I touch upon that we've built upon that are screenplays. That one's a screenplay now. And Claire's the director in the family.
Hi, Maria.
Hi.
I wanted to know, because we've talked a lot about Claire and like the woman side of your relationship. How was it to deal with Jackson's dad and his feelings in a manner that you'll keep him in the relationship, that you're not just hurting and he's running the other direction? How was that, like, dealing with that and making sure that he stayed close?
Hard. I think any shift in relationship, when you realize you really get it, you're living in the question, it's fluid, and to fight for a relationship, right? When we broke up, it was about putting Jack first always. But really getting that we will always be partners in life. We will always have this child together. I don't care if we're not living together, we're not having sex, we will be together forever. So when people say to me, you know, a reporter said the other day, how long were Maria and Dan together? And I said, we're still together. I mean, I think it's that kind of simple, which is you get used to it, right? Things change, and Dan had to adjust in some ways. I had to adjust in some ways. Claire had to adjust. Jack has to adjust. And if we are open to the possibility of our imagination that anything is possible. For me, at least in my life, it's working. Not every day, I got to tell you. Some days I just hate him. And he hates me and Claire hates him and we all hate each other. But most days we're okay.
You know, I think there's the idea that the more loving adults a child has in their life,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how could that be bad?
How
to
could
just
that be
pile
bad?
On the extra people that you can go to when you need love, when you need support, when you need acceptance.
That's right. So true.
Yes, welcome back to San Francisco.
Happy
I have a transgender child who recently has come out to us in the world, and it's going remarkably smoothly here in San Francisco. SFUSD has been remarkably supportive and so on. And our friends and family and community here have been as well. It's actually been remarkably smooth and positive. But one of the universal comments I get from all my friends and family here in the area is, thank God you live in San Francisco. Thank God you don't live in Arkansas, Oklahoma, etc. And so I'm curious, like, on this book tour, are you going to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and so on?
Let me ask you first, how old's your child?
13.
Congratulations. What a huge... He, she, they must have learned something, some great values, to be able to just be and come out and say that and for you to be proud. That's amazing. I do want to say I was in Philadelphia last week and I met my aunt's niece-nephew, Celeste, who wrote me some months ago. She wrote on their Facebook page, I am transgender, non-binary, gender fluid, and this is who I am. And Claire and I sat with her and her dad, who's like Irish Catholic. They come from this huge Irish Catholic family. The grandmother is so lovely. She's 94, and she's like, I love you, Celeste, boy, girl, I don't care what you were. And it's kind of like small town Philly. We're not like from the city part. And so I think things are rapidly changing. I don't think it's just San Francisco anymore. I don't think it's just New York. And the more that we talk about it, the more that we are open about it, the more people will catch on. One of my biggest cities I'm doing is Salt Lake City. It has this incredible community of people fighting for LGBT rights. And I want to say, like, more than half of them are straight or whatever they are, but it doesn't matter. There's this community of love and acceptance, and there's a groundswell, and I'm sure you're really proud. Congratulations. Next. I still can't get the pronouns right. I'm sure you're struggling with that as well. They, their, them. I didn't get it. Okay.
Thank you, Maria, for the talk. In your book, you talk about struggling with our own identity, or I mean, the whole
exactly. What is it? LGBTQRSD.
Yeah. To me, it sounds so inclusive, but it's really very exclusive because it's basically everybody but straight. That's how I summarize it, and I don't like that. It seems, you know, we're being taken out of just society and just kind of in this boat with everybody else unless you're straight. So,
here's what I love about that label. Here's what I love about claiming that label, LGBT. being part of a community that is changing policy and is continually fighting for human rights. And pretty soon, like I said, there'll be like a gazillion of us on the road marching. So, you know, I think this whole the whole idea you're talking about is changing and getting better for it. And I know people want to pigeonhole you. I have this friend, and two women are together, and they are in a relationship with a man who they love very much, who they love being with, having sex with, hanging out with. It's something called like polyamorous. I don't know what it's called, but they have the most loving, gorgeous relationship. And I think, okay, what's the label for that? So are they not lesbian, gay, bi? I don't know what they are. Does anyone have an idea what we would call that? I don't know.
Polyamorous or open?
Polyamorous. But very happy indeed.
Hi. So I'm sort of like at the beginning of that generation that doesn't really freak out as much about sexual identity. Unfortunately, like not early enough to be completely unfreaked out. But I've always sort of identified myself as queer, which I guess this sort of sounds similar to whatever. But I'm wondering, given that there's this whole academic body of writing on queerness, that so many people have discussed it, that it's seen as sort of this umbrella term for people who are non-normative, how is that different than whatever? How is it similar? Like, where do you fit into that discussion? I have thoughts on how they might be different or similar, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's funny. Claire and I were sitting with some new friends the other day, and we were talking about the labels that they give themselves, and one of our friends, Raina, is very proudly transgender and speaks all over the country about it. And Sasha, I said, are you transgender too? I mean, you just don't know, right? And by the way, she's like this tall, little, tiny thing. She definitely wasn't, but she, okay. And she said, no, I identify as queer, and here's why. Because queer to me is a political stance, right? It's a political stance. And I'm certainly about exactly that. I'm a Q2. Driving policy, that's it. It's a political stance. For me, being a whatever is a personal stance. It's about labels that don't make you feel judged or ashamed. You claiming the labels that make you feel good and getting rid of the ones that don't feel good.
Well, I want you all to join me in thanking the astonishing, the beautiful, the brilliant, the hilarious Maria Bello.
Thank you. And thank you all very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actress and activist Maria Bello, whose new book is Whatever, Love is Love, Questioning the Labels We Give Ourselves. She was joined in conversation by author Ayelet Waldman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.